haven't been able to call.
We'll be surprised.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Today we have a report that from the Debt Advisory Commission, and this was done before, and actually one of my staffers went, and it got extremely good reviews. So we are, I decided to have this represented to our committee, and thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, do you want to say anything before she gets started?
Madam Chair, the one thing I guess I would add is that Laura has agreed to help us update some of these measures when we get the new forecast numbers. So we'll have those right away for you. And since we are anticipating the forecast going down a bit, that might give us some insight as to how that will affect the overall debt capacity.
I must say, for the record, Laura Lockham McCall, Director of Debt Management Division in the State Treasurer's Office. I will present the material to Paul, but I actually will be in Southern California celebrating the 51st birthday version of my mother's birth of me that weekend, so I won't be there. You know, I don't celebrate my birthday.
I celebrate my mother's labor,
I guess, if that's the best way to describe it. So, but yes, we will do that because as we were putting together the report this winter, we used the December revenue forecast numbers, as you'll see, as the basis of all of our debt capacity forecasting. And we knew that really, you know, as the ink was drying, that the numbers could change. So I will show you what the numbers showed you, and then there will be somebody from Treasury or else Paul can do it very ably, I'm sure, himself, just updating what you see today.
That's terrific. And if you could just give us for today's presentation, you know, kind of an order of magnitude, whether a reduced forecast is going to have a big effect or a small effect.
You will see it shortly. It was built into even the way we wrote the report this session.
Great.
Because we had that suspicion that we
Thank
might
you.
Be doing
and
that.
And you're lucky you will be there and not here.
I have looked at the weather forecast. It will be similar weather, so not as lucky as I had hoped.
And hopefully no other forecasts will be similar.
Yeah. Well, as long as the rain goes in the rainy day fund, we're good.
Okay, there you have
Sorry.
It.
Sorry. Okay.
Oh, we'd be flush.
All right, go
Just as a little background for new members of this committee, we do an annual debt capacity forecast as required under state law, 286A, 255. And what that has been doing for over a decade is providing both the legislature and the governor a larger policy framework to make debt decisions. It certainly isn't the be-all and end-all, and you make decisions about how to deploy your debt resource in the context of your overall budget and your overall economic development strategies as a state. But I think it would be fair to say that the states that do use this approach, and we're one of several that do this approach, generally is viewed very favorably by the credit ratings because that shows that you're doing planning, you're thinking, and you're managing your overall debt. So, you know, I have some ratios I'm going to show you. They're not absolutes, but I think it's a good methodology to help people think about this issue. So with that, under the state constitution, there's a $50,000 debt limitation, and the only way that you get around that debt limitation is you have to have, if you're going to pledge the full faith and credit, is you have to get voter approval. So you often hear about 11G, 11F, 11J. Well, that's Article 11, Section, and then you pick the letter, and those are all voter-approved general obligation bond programs as exceptions to this $50,000 debt limitation in the Constitution. We have lots of different kinds of general obligation bonds with very, very high debt limits. They're typically linked to real market value thresholds that are far in excess of anything that we think would be prudent for the state. But nevertheless, that's the methodology the Constitution put together. We have both general fund-backed general obligation bonds, and then we have a lot of different types of self-supporting general obligation bonds. And you'll see as we talk about the debt capacity model why that's important. Some examples of self-supporting programs include veteran mortgage loans, historically SELP loans, which is a small-scale energy loan program, although that's changing in terms of the general fund participation in that program. Another example would be DEQ. About half or maybe a little bit more than half has been general fund supported. So you can see as we talk about new programs, which I'll mention in a moment, things like seismic safety loan programs for cities, counties, school districts, for public safety and schools, the decision can be made to either provide that as a loan, which might be self-supporting, or as a grant, in which case the general fund will have to step in and will become part of the overall conversation about debt capacity. We also have a lot of direct revenue bond programs. Again, we have a mortgage program for first-time home buyers through Oregon Housing Community Services. We have a highway user tax bonds for ODOT projects. And we have, I'm trying to think of another third, lottery revenue bonds, which we do have a debt capacity model that we'll share with you shortly. Appropriation credits include the certificates of participation as well as appropriation deficit bonds that were issued in 2003. I think the main thing to understand or to think about with COPs is that because of this debt limitation, these are not voter approved, but clever lawyers in many parts of the United States who have similar issues have created these lease participations. So you take a bond and you chop it up and you call it a lease financing and you sell the COPs just like you sell a bond. And what you do is they're subject to annual appropriation. They're typically collateralized with property. And if the legislature failed to make an appropriation for something, well, we'd lose the property. Of course, we'd also lose our credit rating and our good name. So
what kind of property are our COPs collateralized
with? Typically, it's the state prison, it's the state mental hospital, state office buildings, things that would be very difficult to convince voters, at least in our state and probably in most states, that that's a really great use of general obligation bonds. That's not to say that it couldn't be done. Some states have very different constitutional frameworks and sell all their debt through general obligation bonds. But in our state, in California, it was often very common to do this.
So if the worst happened, they'd come and take over our prison?
If you chose not to make the debt service payments, and we wouldn't be able to borrow for anything else, because at the end of the day, it's not only is it the essentiality of the prison, but it's also, do you want to come back into the credit markets ever again? You know, if you welch on your debt, you don't get to play. So essentiality is really important.
This environment, getting rid of the prisons, doesn't really sound too bad.
Well,
short-term
gain, long-term pain kind of thing. So, but in essence, I mean, the key point here is that it's usually the credit rating on COPs is one notch below what your general obligation credit rating, the theory being that it's not quite as secure as full faith in credit, but it's still a secure credit because everybody knows that you don't want to mess up your credit rating if you need to use the market frequently. So that's what a COP is. And then lastly, we have things called conduit revenue bonds or pass-through revenue bonds. And these are various types of borrowers under federal tax law that are given permission to take advantage of the tax exemption that's available under federal law. But they're really their own borrowing capacity. So, for example, we do industrial development bonds for small businesses. There's some limitations on what we can do. We sell bonds for nonprofits through the Oregon Facilities Authority, and we also have multifamily housing projects that are issued through Oregon Housing Community Services. So that's the bulk of that group of borrowers. This shows you just a 10-year history of kind of where we stand with the major types of debt. I should also point out that we sold pension obligation bonds in 2003. We took a unfunded liability in PERS, and the state's case was roughly $2 billion, or maybe a little bit more than that. And we were funding that at an 8% rate, because when you have an unfunded liability in PERS, you know, it's equivalent to what the rate of return would be. Well, we were able to go out in the credit markets and sell general obligation bonds on a taxable basis at 5.75%. And we took an off-balance sheet liability, and we put it on our balance sheet, and I'll talk a little bit more about the implications from debt ratios. But I think it's important to note that, you know, if we had put the unfunded liability in this table, which I didn't have access to the data to do, you'd see that perhaps the overall liability of the state hasn't changed as fundamentally, perhaps, as this table looks. We did do appropriation deficit bonds, and we'll talk about those more. Those will be paid off in full by the year 2014. And then lastly, you see the big growth area has been in the last decade has been in these direct revenue bonds. Two points I'd like to make. One is that the cost of everything is more expensive, construction costs. And so Oregon Housing Community Services is processing roughly the same number of loans per year as they used to, but the dollar value of those loans has grown substantially, and therefore the direct revenue bonds associated with have grown. But secondly, we've been doing a lot of bonds for OTIA. And so as the OTIA bond program, which is $2.4 billion that was authorized since 2001, is implemented, you're going to just see that the amount of overall debt growing at a faster pace than the Fed. And we're paying it off. Please interrupt me if you have questions. So these are the categories in the report. General fund supported debt is obviously a number one priority for the commission. For many years, we've been using a 5% debt service as a percentage of general fund revenues as the methodology or the target limit. The commission wanted to make extra special sure that this year that I stated that it doesn't mean that that's what we should issue, that that's an upper limit, and that we need to use it carefully, especially in a time of downturn in the revenue stream. Since we are using general fund revenues as our basis of this analysis, as that drops, you will see that what the chair asked me to show you in a moment, that it has a big it could have a big impact on future debt capacity. These are the types of bond programs that are part of the general fund debt in our calculation. It totals $2.5 billion at the end of fiscal year 08. And as I mentioned, it includes all the 11G debt that's general fund backed, and then portions of other types of debt programs that have some general fund kick in. Historically, alternative energy bonds have been self-supporting, but we discovered that since 2005, legislature has authorized a number of programs where there is a general fund kick-in. So it's not a large dollar amount, but I think it's important to just kind of keep aware of that. Pension obligation bonds, which is the single largest issue we've done, only 38% is funded through general fund. The rest is funded with other funds around the state. So while the full faith and credit of the state's on the line, from a general fund debt capacity perspective, we're assuming that they're taking care of their portion of the debt. We also took a look this year at COPs, and we've actually backed out a portion of COPs. We've discerned through talking with DAS that actually only about 85% of that billion-dollar plus of COPs that we have outstanding is really general fund in nature. I mentioned the new programs for seismic safety. We're assuming they will be general fund supported, and so as the legislature debates this session, that will be something new to add to the pot. Yes, sir.
Senator Hess.
Could you give an example of pension obligation bonds? Pension obligation bonds.
What is the question, sir?
What?
Well, we sold bonds in 2003 specifically to fund the unfunded liability for PERS. Many cities and counties and school districts did something similar. And again, it was really an opportunity to lower the cost that we were amortizing that unfunded liability at. So we sold them on a taxable basis, but they were general obligations of the state.
Okay. So it was part of that PERS reform?
Yes, sir.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Those were sold on the basis of arbitraging.
Yes, sir.
And given the status of the market, where do we stand today? Do we have a net
positive
delta or negative?
I don't have that information, and I can get it for you. But I can tell you that through the last, when we went into the budget cycle, that we were saving roughly $130 to $160 million per biennium because we had a positive earnings well above the borrowing costs from 2003 through 2007. And I'm not sure that 2008's bad, which, I don't know the final number yet, to be honest with you, took away the fact that we were so far ahead. We were at 116% funding in PERS as of the end of 2007. So that should give you a sense that we sold the bonds at a good moment. We did really well for a number of years, but that's an annual calculation we'll have to do for the life of the entire bond issue to decide whether it was a good decision or a bad decision. But I know that I've heard the executive director per se it was a really good decision, at least until you get to 2008. But I can get some more information. I'm not prepared to answer the question for you today.
No, okay, thank you. Can you just follow up, Madam Chair?
Please.
Did the commission factor in the current standing of the invested funds in their recommendations?
It's not a direct part at this point of the analysis, but I do have some slides later to show you at least how the rating agencies are looking at that situation, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Several slides forward. Any other questions?
Go ahead.
Okay. This is just a visual way for you to see as we do the development of the debt capacity model, and this is just the types of general fund back bonds I'm talking about. You see the large jump up in 2004 when the pension obligation bonds were issued, the big thing in green. And you see the appropriation deficit bonds. Just a brief word about those. Towards the end of the 2001-2003 session, the revenues were dropping precipitously, and the state was really running out of time in order to try and close that gap budgetarily. Decision was made to issue some appropriation deficit bonds. It was done by California as well as Oregon. I'm not sure about other states. And basically, we took an operating deficit and we bonded it out. We got some money and we basically agreed to repay that debt over a 10-year period. The general fund was pledged, but the tobacco settlement dollars are the actual source of repayment for that particular bond issue. And you see that those bonds are being paid off the top, little purple, fairly rapidly at this point. And so the debt, for the most part, will be almost extinguished by 2013, but completely by 2014 year end. That, along with the fact that we do pay off other debt, as you know, we're issuing and we're retiring, and we try and keep the term of the debt short enough that it is recycling, but long enough that it reduces the annual debt service. It's sort of finding that optimal blend between length and recycling, that's what provides us with capacity. We get the general fund forecast. It goes out 6 years, and then we factor in all of the debt that the legislature has authorized, but we haven't issued yet. We put that in the model, and then we also look at all the debt that's being paid off to come up with our forecasted future capacity. This is just a math formula. My statement about there's no absolutes about the 5%, but it is a sort of good rule of thumb that's used by a number of states around the country. I do know of states that have higher than 5% as far as the ratio of debt service as a percentage of operating revenues or operating expenses. But we've tried to stay at the 5% because we thought that was a good working model. This is what went into the model in terms of the dollar amounts when we did the forecast. Again, the December forecast, we use an assumption of an average length of about 20 years for our bonds. And also, we assumed something different. And historically, we've looked past 5 years and said, okay, the interest rate for the last 5 years on average, that's what we'll use for the next 6 years. We felt that was sort of risky given the current interest rate environment. And although we just priced bonds this past week at an all-in cost of roughly 4.45%, we were a little nervous going forward that interest rates will stay where they are. So we used one full point, above what the five-year forecast historical averages have been. And we use that target. And this is the result. And what you see is based on, this is again also before the economic stimulus package that just went through the legislature was adopted, but based on what had been approved already by the 07 and 08 legislatures, we would end the fiscal year based on our forecast of issuance at roughly 3.89%. That's debt service as a percentage of general fund revenues. As revenues drop, that ratio will go up. As we issue more bonds under the economic stimulus package that the legislature adopted, that ratio will go up. So one of the things that you'll see when we come back with new information is what the ratio probably will likely be now. The other piece of the equation is...
Do you think that there's any chance that we'd get above that 7% where we start to get into imprudence?
I think you would if you did that. And I think the imprudent aspect of it, Senator Burdick, is that in a down economy, when you're having to cut your budget, this is a fixed cost. Because, again, if you want to ever have access to the credit markets, you can't really even assume that you can cut one penny of that. So to my way of thinking as a legislator or as a fiscal officer, you don't want to tie your hands that deeply. That you know, to have that much debt on you, it makes it difficult because everything else has to be cut more when you're cutting back.
But my question was, and maybe I didn't understand your answer, we've got... You know, projected 5% with changes. Top over the 7%.
No, I don't. What this model isn't saying, that's 5%. All it's saying is, if you want to go to 5% every year, this is how much you can issue.
Oh, I got it.
Okay. Yeah. So where I was headed was is that because we're paying off debt, and I showed you that graph that shows you how quickly we pay it off, you have some debt capacity in 10 and 11, but you get a lot of debt capacity once the appropriation deficit bonds get paid off in particular. So some years you get more in the early years, and some years you get more in the late years. So historically, the way we've averaged for both lottery bonds and general fund is that give us a six-year forecast, divide by three. And we can keep fixing this. We do this model every year. We can make mid-course adjustments. So that's how we came to the forecast of the 1.1. We simply divided by three. Okay. Now, what we did do, as I mentioned we would do, is we said, what if every year the general fund forecast was off by 10%? So that's an across-the-board. And I guess that's potentially historically possible, although I don't know if, you know, in the short run, whether it will stay that way. But what that would be to reduce our general fund debt capacity, it's a 5% ratio, by about $200 million per biennium. So there would still be capacity, but obviously it would be a little more constrained than it's been. Similarly, we said, well, what if we're wrong about our interest forecast? Because here we went a full basis, full 100 basis points higher than we have seen historically. And you can see that hurts us by about $100 million per biennium. Not quite as big an impact, and we think we've already built in a fairly good cushion. So this is an example of what Paul mentioned, but we'll be bringing back to you a table that looks just like this to tell you, based on the new revenue forecast, you know, what's the sensitivity analysis for based on further reductions. Lottery bonds have funded many, many programs around the state, anything that has to do with education or economic development, and I don't think this is an exhaustive list. We, until recently, only sold lottery bonds for 15 years. We were the first state in the country to try to use our lottery revenue to create a bond issue, and so when it was first developed, people were kind of nervous about the credit. So we have a fairly strong coverage, which is you can only, you know, in the case of a revenue bond, you have a limit on how much you can borrow, and in our case for lottery bonds, it's one to four. So the maximum we can borrow is 1/4 of the net proceeds from the lottery, and we kept the term short. So that means we're recycling debt fairly quickly. This program's been around, and that's why even though we've issued a lot of lottery bonds over the years, we still have a lot of capacity. I use the same methodology, which was a December forecast, with this 4x coverage instead of the 5% ratio is the only difference. The legislature had authorized $486 million in lottery bonds, and that was what went in the model. But before I show you the outcomes, I just wanted to just sort of give you a flavor. So you can see we've been roughly in the same zone in terms of our outstanding lottery indebtedness. It's been going up a bit. And the dashed line just shows you the coverage requirements. And then the upper line shows you what our actual coverage was, which has been significantly higher. When line games were introduced in 2005, it had a very positive impact, as you all know, on lottery revenue. It also helped us improve our credit rating for the lottery bond program, and we were upgraded to AAA by Standard & Poor's. And we were in the AA category for Moody's, which at one point meant that we had a higher credit rating for our lottery bonds than we did for the state as a general obligation credit.
What kind of message do you
have? Well, it's because we had very, very high coverage levels. It also is because Standard & Poor's started moving towards a global scale where they were looking at corporate and municipal credits more with similar eyes, and you trying to harmonize those scales. So everybody thought it was crazy when it happened. It's just that our general obligation ratings, at least with Moody's and Fitch, hasn't necessarily moved to that global scale. So we're kind of in this weird zone where I don't know, you know, the different rating agencies have different sort of approaches. But I just want to point out that revenues really shot up, and we're forecasting selling quite a lot of lottery revenue bonds, and we do think our coverage is going to be starting to come down, of course. And it will be interesting to see whether we continue to maintain that AAA rating in the years to come. The forecast, this again is prior to the economic stimulus package, would have had us at about 7.4x coverage, which is fairly high. And then using this same limit, which is the 4x coverage, not as an absolute you should go to it, but rather as this is the maximum you could possibly bond, at least unless we change the indenture and went to a lower coverage. We have roughly $1.2 billion over the 6-year period. Whoops. So we, again, divided by 3, and said don't use it all up at once, even if you could. And that's how we come to the $400 million per biennium number. A 10% decline across the whole 6 years of the revenue forecast would drop capacity by roughly $80 million per biennium. And so we try to use something similar. Obviously, we'll come back and show you this slide as well when the February forecast comes out. And we're happy to do other number crunching if you tell us what kind of crunching you want. But we thought 10% was easy for people to kind of to get a sense of scale. If it's a 5% change, you can kind of do your own math to figure out the difference. Are there any questions about lottery bonds? The next thing I wanted to touch on is, well, how do we compare to other states? And what's really tricky and challenging is that 50 states have 50 constitutions, 50 budget schemes, and different kinds of debts. So what the rating agencies do is they tend to homogenize all debt that has any kind of tax support, whether it's in the general fund or it's not in the general fund, and they call it net tax support of debt. And that's the only yardstick that's been developed that anybody's come up with to try and compare in more of an apples-to-apples approach. So for our state, they take our general fund supported debt that I've told you about, the $2.5 billion. They add in all the pension obligation bonds, whether they're self-supporting or general fund supported. Our COPs that weren't on the table, our lottery revenue bonds, and our highway user bonds. And the next page shows you then, when you add all that together, we're a little north of $6 billion. The tables show you the net tax-supported debt per capita, which they rank us compared to other states, and then they also do the same debt ratio as a percentage of personal income. I prefer personal income. I think it's at least closer to a wealth measure and maybe a little bit more meaningful, but it's been pointed out to me by former revenue forecaster Michael Kennedy that there's a lot of income that doesn't really get captured by the national statistics on personal income, so there's weaknesses with that particular choice as well, but there isn't anything better, so that's what everybody uses. And so what that shows, and we did it with and without the pension bonds, and this is an important consideration, some states chose to sell pension obligation bonds, some states didn't. Those of us that did, it shows up in our debt ratio. So Oregon went from being the 38th highest in terms of debt from a debt ratio standpoint to the 11th, the moment we sold pension bonds, when we look at Moody's medians, which is on the next page. So you can see the green little bars is Moody's medians for the personal income ratio. And we're right about at the median. We're the blue underneath that. We were right at the median. However, when we sold the pension obligation bonds, which is what's represented up on top, we jumped up to 11th. What I'd also point out, though, is that even if you take out the pension bonds, since 2004, as we started selling these OTIA bonds, we're above the national medians even with that. So we aren't in the bottom third any longer, I think it's clear, under any scenario. However, I think I want to now go back to the PERS comments that were asked about earlier. It was very frustrating because here we have this really well-funded pension system. We've done a really good job of pension reform. But somehow, when we would go meet with the rating agencies, Moody's still thought we had really high debt ratios. Standard & Poor's thought we had very modest debt ratios. And it would drive me and the former treasurer slightly batty that we would have such completely different viewpoints about the same topic. About a year and a half ago, Standard & Poor's finally published a report, and it was awfully tough to do to get all this information about different pension systems around the country. But what they did was they took your net tax-supported debt, and then they also took the balance sheets for all the pension systems of all the states. They added the two together and then used this personal income ratio and developed a new standard. They said, well, let's look at overall liabilities, what's on your balance sheet, what's off your balance sheet, in one comprehensive way, as best they could. And lo and behold, Oregon turned out to be third best in the United States. The two who are above us probably don't even have pension systems for their employees. They were in fairly small states. And again, it's because our PERS, at least as of the end, this report's a couple years lag, and you got to appreciate that it's hard to get the data, so it's going to be a little laggy. This was as of the end of 06. But it used debt data that was a little bit newer. But the combination shows that because our PERS situation was so positive, even though we had higher than average net tax supported debt, when you combine them compared to the AAAs, let alone the national medians, we were light years ahead.
So with the fall in the stock market, we can expect to see that.
I think our ratio will go up, but so will every other pension system in the United States.
Yeah.
So we will all move together. I think that's what we'll probably find once they get. Now, next year they'll be using 07 numbers. We're going to look pretty good. So it will be 2 years from now before you'll start really being able to see the real changes that we're talking about. But I think on a relative basis to our peers, we're doing okay. There's many states that were not 116% funded, let alone 90% funded. When the state did the POBs, we were at 90% funded. Some states will probably be 50% funded. And so those states will have to use their debt financing skills and tools probably in the future and their budgets to address their unfunded liabilities. We'll be working on our infrastructure.
Now, when you get, you know, when you get POBs, there's no way that you can get in there and pay them off early.
I wish I could tell you they could. Those are sold on a taxable basis under federal tax law. They're not tax exempt. So the number of buyers and the people who we found to buy those bonds is more equivalent to the corporate markets. And they were sold. You couldn't sell them with call features. You'd have to either do a make-whole call or something. And so, in essence, they're very, very hard to refinance or get rid of. Now, I have done it in another state, and it was a real nightmare. You had to do a tender program, and you had to pay premium above the price of the bond. The other problem is once the money's in PERS, it sort of stays in PERS. And so it's not as easy just to unlock it and bring it back to the state. But what I will say is that at least we're going to probably be in about 90% funded range with PERS, would be roughly where I think we'll probably be going forward. And I think PERS has developed some new methodology for how they evaluate what your rates are going to be so that you don't go down more than 3% in any budget cycle and you don't go up more than 3%. And that's a new method of doing actuarial sort of smoothing. The rating agencies give us really strong marks. And so we're no longer to be overfunded. If that was your concern, and you wanted the money to pay the bonds off,
so you know. In this kind of economy, it does look smart that back then we did get the.
You betcha, bonds. As somebody would say from Alaska, you betcha.
You see pressure from your
absolutely. Health. I don't think too many states have been able to quite do the kind of comprehensive reform. And let me further add that. Under GASB, which is a government accounting standards board, over the next few years, local, state governments, everybody's going to have to start reporting the other post-employment benefits called OPEBs. And there are enormous OPEBs nationally. The state has very limited. Unfortunately for me, I don't get quite a lot for retiree health care. But as an employer, the state of Oregon is very well positioned. There's school districts, there's counties, there's all sorts of people that I know about who make promises to pay retiree health care till people die. And those are going to all have to go on balance sheets, all have to be reported and dealt with. And it's an enormous problem that's just sitting like an iceberg under the water that's about to explode nationally. We don't have that problem.
We don't have that much, even at the
we
local
have a
level.
We reported in our official statements, we have a small program. We have very modest programs. We do provide an implicit subsidy for folks through PEB who tend to be the sicker people who have or else have dependent care. But if our goal as a society and our culture and our state is to provide health care, it's probably a good thing that folks can buy into the state's plan. But no, the state doesn't have a problem. Now, every school district in the state is going to have to report. TriMet's going to have to report, counties and cities, and that's going to be really quite fascinating to see for Oregon as well as nationally what those numbers look like.
So you don't have a sense of how...
The largest communities already have had to start reporting. So I've heard some numbers, and I don't want to be quoted today. The TriMet, for example, has a really large OPEB liability. I know the state doesn't, but I don't really have data. It's been rolled out over a few years, and I think folks in the controller's office would know more. The smaller communities have more years before they have to start reporting it. In California, I think LA Unified School District has a multi-billion dollar unfunded liability in that area. That's just one example that I know about. I can get you a report if you want to see some statistics about what people are thinking it's going to cost. I'm happy to forward that to Paul. But people are mostly just doing back of the envelope sort of thumb guesses at the moment. And I'll continue to provide this annual report from Standard & Poor's to the legislature each year, you know, to just sort of do a reality check if we're still looking as good. These are the programs that are the non-tax supported programs. These are the ones that each have their own sort of form of self-supporting that I've mentioned earlier to you today. And each of them is fairly well managed. We haven't had really too many problems other than the fact that some have variable rate bonds in their portfolios. And because of the larger international meltdown in the credit markets, there were some weeks where our weekly resets for our veterans mortgage bonds and in fact, also our ODOT interest rates shot up dramatically. 2% suddenly went to like 8%. And it had nothing to do with us, how we managed the program. It had everything to do with Dexia, which was a bank that would provide liquidity for our variable rate programs that suddenly France, Belgium, and Luxembourg were trying to rescue when we were rescuing AIG and Fannie and Freddie Mac. Those rates have come back down. Dexia's still not as good as others, but I would say that all the programs seem to be back to whatever the new normal is. The tricky part for veterans welfare bonds, for Oregon Housing Community Service, single family program, and for ODOT will be, once those liquidity agreements expire, will there be anybody left on the planet to provide liquidity? We don't know yet. We'll get back to you on that. It's sad, though, because in many cases we're talking about variable rate programs that help blend down the cost of funds. Right now we're paying less than 1%. It's really hard to turn those variable rate programs into fixed rate programs and pay. Even if it's 4.5% to 5%, it's hard. It's heartbreaking to not try and match assets and liabilities if you can. So that's one of my goals in the next 2 years, is to start continuing to look at, to talk to the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission and to obviously folks here in the legislature about possible solutions to the alternative of having to fix everything out. Which, you know, we can do, but it may not be optimal for each of those programs.
And why do we have to do that? Why do we have to?
Well, liquidity agreements, the way a variable rate program works so that they're eligible for money markets to purchase is that they have a weekly reset, but the people who hold those bonds or those notes can put them back to you at any time. And so what you do is you get a liquidity provider who's basically willing to provide that cash. Okay, and then, but hopefully that never happens because there's some other investor who will buy them instead. What happened for Dexia is there was sort of this, the credit, it was besmirched and everybody panicked and they all put their bonds back at the same token at the moment. So the only way to get them out of being in this, in the bank bond mode was to offer much higher interest rates to investors to entice them back. But this variable rate program, because you have money markets, it's trillions of dollars in this market. And so you get very, very attractive low interest costs. When you have a lot of cash on your balance sheet, Veterans has a lot of cash, ODOT has a lot of cash, we have less risk by having a portion of their overall debt portfolio in a variable rate mode. So they float together. And then if you had everything fixed but then you had short-term assets, you've got a bit of a mismatch. So we've only really done variable rate debt to match assets and liabilities for these programs. It tends to help lower the interest cost for both veterans mortgages as well as for Oregon Housing, the first-time home buyers. So it would be heartbreaking, as you said, to lose that. I think it would make it harder to be able to provide an attractive interest rate for first-time home buyers. For ODOT, we have a lot of cash, and we've been able to just blend on our borrowing costs. You know, we had a long-term plan for OTIA debt. We felt if we could have a long-term borrowing of 5.5% over 10 years, we'd be really happy. Well, so far, our long-term borrowing costs have been 4.5%, and that's on $1.8 billion. That adds up to some serious real money in terms of the interest savings we've been able to achieve. So it's a tool. It's not for every department and for every agency, but our goal is to try and optimize our borrowings and be as efficient and effective as possible. This is really concluding. I'm pretty much done. If there's any other questions, then.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Laura, and thank you for this presentation. I guess what is troubling me is the environment that we find ourselves in and its impact on how much indebtedness that we're going to incur in this session. And a couple of things. One would be very helpful, and I know it's just an estimate. It'd be qualified as an estimate, but for lottery bonds and general fund-backed bonds, those two categories, if you could give us a debt service, annual debt service, for each of those categories, what would be estimated per $100 million of borrowing, or put it in some increments so that we can scale it.
Okay, I will go back to my model, but just off the top of my head, if you wanted a good rule of thumb with a little fudge factor, I usually go 10 to 1, but it's really about 1 to 11. In other words, it depends on the interest rate you use. But just to be conservative, if you heard $100 million and you kind of just put in your head, it's $10 million minus a little bit. That's probably a pretty good rule of thumb because it's about 20-year debt. But if you wanted me to be real precise, I could come back and give that to you. But I always, in the top of my head, when somebody says $100 million in borrowing,
so
I think $10 million or $9 million,
$5 million. A biennium?
No, per year.
Per year.
Yeah. I think a good analogy is think about your mortgage. If you have a home mortgage, granted, slightly higher rate. But if you really thought about how much you pay per year, principal and interest, and you think about the size of that mortgage, there's sort of a rough correlation of your annual payment. It's not perfect, but I think it's close enough, as I say, for government work if you're thinking about it. So, but I can get back with Paul with some a little bit more precision if that would be of benefit to you.
That would be appreciated. Just further comments, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
From a business model perspective, I mean, that's where I come from, and I can't help it, I guess, but thinking about declining revenues in your businesses, you know, if you have reductions in many businesses that are 20, 30, 40% off, the idea of increasing indebtedness, which compounds the meeting your current payables. And has anyone ever thought about analyzing our debt capacity in light of a ratio to a central budget level service? So that if you're looking at an expectation that we're going to continue our critical services and what is required to fund those, based on the revenue, how much do you have left for debt service?
I haven't been asked to do that, and I think the problem is that I'm just a debt person, and I'm not the person who does the essential level budgets. That's really, I guess, the governor's budget officer. But I would be happy to work backwards by you telling me, this is how much debt service our budget can afford, and then we can tell you, this is how much debt that debt represents. We've been sort of doing it the other way around. We've been saying, no more than 5%, and then we just tell you the number. But if somebody told us, we want debt service to be no more than, pick a number out of the air, $250 million, we could certainly tell you with relative accuracy, that's about how much, this is how much debt you can afford, this is how much you've got issued, this is what's, you know, going to be issued, and this is what's left. So I'd be happy to crunch that number, but you've got to tell me the debt service number first. Okay, or have the budget officer tell me what that number is.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
It's very, very troublesome. We have a report that says we can borrow $1.5 billion.
But
we can't borrow it without consequences to meeting our current payables.
Mm-hmm.
And how much can we borrow? It's in flux. I mean, we don't know what the stimulus is going to bring to us from the Feds.
True.
We don't know what the revenue exactly is going to be. But this is, all has to be.
I would agree that our report is a little bit more like the tail wagging the dog, and I recognize that. Just that it's the four corners of my job, and at least how the debt capacity has been looked at. But as I said, if the budget officers, if the Ways and Means tells us, or the commission, you know, next time tell us, okay, we don't want debt service to be more than this number, we could easily tune up the model in reverse. You know, we've sort of assumed that you don't want more than 5% of your budget tied up with debt service. You could say 4%, or you could say a dollar threshold, and we can work backwards. If that makes sense to the commission.
Yeah.
But I need your help or others to be able to really be able to answer that question for you.
We'll assign Senator Morris to do that. Draw on your Ways and Means experience.
We wouldn't be borrowing much.
But I do think that the commission recognizes this session. I mean, and I want to be really fair. We usually have one meeting, and people see my slides and they go away. They made me come back and write more and more. And the, you know, whether you really read the commission's report, which is electronically available on the Treasurer's website, or we can get you a copy. We put in lots of language about just because this is the maximum doesn't mean you should go there. But at the time that the report was published, that's as far as, you know, frankly, the commission felt that it could go.
Now, how long have you been in this debt gig that you've got
here or elsewhere?
Here.
I put many a government into debt. I'm afraid that's a horrible thing to say. I worked for here in the state of Oregon for a little over 4 years. I spent many, many, many years in California in county government and city government, and I've worked on the East Coast as well in county and state government, primarily as a budget officer as well as a debt finance person.
You came here just as our last recession was ending. Our last
I was in the same recession in California.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, you know, we
same
did
moon,
one
recession.
Of the things that distressed me during that recession is we did a lot of borrowing, and we did accounting tricks, we did borrowing, we did, you know, all kinds of things. And I'm just wondering if you've acquired any institutional memory of that and have any observations.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, my observation is that using debt, it's a very powerful tool. They always talk about the wizard. You know, it's an extraordinarily powerful tool that can be used for good, it can be used for bad. And the tricky part for a legislative body in this environment is figuring out what's good. I guess if you had a few months left and you couldn't cut anymore, I don't think appropriation deficit bonds is particularly smart. Definitely got the state downgraded. Obviously, the rating agencies have told you what they think of that. However, they weren't sitting in your shoes. They weren't making the decisions you were trying to make. And so I don't know myself personally what I would do if I were sitting across the table from you.
So that's what we did last time, correct? Because I wasn't following the
money. I wasn't here, but my understanding was is that the March forecast came out, people had been cutting and cutting, and the story that I've been told is that, frankly, they had cut so hard, so far to the bone, that this was the lesser of two evils, which was to use appropriation deficit funding to basically close the last $430 million, give or take, that needed to be cut.
That was the right number. I just don't remember what type of bond it was.
Sure. It was our appropriation deficit bond. We basically bonded out our deficit. California bonded it out for more than 10 years, but what they did was they imposed a sales tax surcharge so that as revenues came in, somebody mentioned, can we pay these things off early? Well, they did. They issued it in a variable rate mode, and so it was easy to call it, even if it was taxable, because it was a taxable. Well, I think theirs was taxable. I'm not sure ours was. I think ours was tax exempt. Maybe there was.
So what was the hit? What was the hit in terms of our credit rating?
We had the one notch downgrade, which we stayed in that mode. When I got here, we were AA minus for GO, and then we were A plus for COPs. Treasurer Edwards and I spent a lot of time the first couple of years I was here working to try and get the upgrade. The number one, one thing is they started holding the appropriation deficit bonds against us less as time went by. The S&P report came out, and we were able to beat our chest and say how great we were with pensions and pension reform. But ultimately, the rainy day fund made all the difference, because the rainy day fund is now there as the buffer so that if you do run into that situation towards the end of a biennial period where you're running out of time, it may not be the best choice or what you would like to do, but it does provide you with some cushion to cope with uncertainty. And so the rainy day fund is probably the single biggest reason the state got its upgrade.
So we have, we're going to be, Senator Morris and I are sponsoring a bill this session to divert kicker income into the rainy day fund, which will provide not necessarily predictable, but probably more reliable chunk of funding. Will that do anything if we pull that
out?
Will
that,
will it help?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we wait till you all act, and when you do things like that, then we promote that. And my job is to market the state to Wall Street as in the most positive light if possible. And so those are helpful measures. What will also help is initiative reform, the other major thing that is held against us. And, again, it's a value decision whether it's good or bad, because I believe in democracy, and I think it's a pretty cool thing that citizens can change their constitution and their government. But because we have so many initiatives with so many budget impacts that we cannot predict, these little landmines, they will always hold that against us. They hold it against other states that have similar types of initiative processes. So that's a value decision. You have to decide, is it more important to have a AAA, or is it more important to have a slightly lower credit rating, a little bit higher borrowing costs, and have democracy? You know, I worked in a state that didn't have that, and it was a AAA. I'm not sure it was a better state. It was just a different state.
Another question?
Chris, did you have a question?
No.
If I may make a request, if it's possible, and this is absolutely a value judgment and it would be considered as such, with the adoption of this reform bill that we're talking about, the way we forecast to actually create a constitutionally dedicated rainy day fund in addition to the constitutionally dedicated education stability fund.
Yes, sir.
Could you give us some expectation of the benefit? Okay, I'm asking. I said it's value judgment. Some estimate of the benefit in our credit rating as it is translated into interest cost.
I think that would be very. It would be. What I can do for you is I can tell you that I can't tell you you're going to get the credit rating upgrade. Okay, but I can tell you what generally speaking, the value of each notch in terms of your change in credit rating would be, in terms of what the interest rate differential. Right now, it's very wide. The difference between a AA3 and a AA2, Moody's, was 0.15%. Okay? Sometimes it's really narrow. Sometimes people don't notice the difference between high and low credits, like a year ago. Now everybody's hypersensitive and there's huge credit spreads. So it's a little tough for me to tell you with the kind of certainty you're hoping for fiscal impact, we will save this much money. But I can tell you the difference between a AA, AA minus, what it means based on the amount of debt we have outstanding.
I can tell you that
because I feel like with some certainty that's an analytically robust, and I'll look at, I don't know if the right word, if I use the word, is an analytically acceptable approach that Paul could kick the tires on and he could, okay, that's reasonable.
Okay, could you?
But I can't predict it's going to change the rating in and of itself. That's a problem.
Could you take our credit rating before we adopted the rainy day fund?
Yes.
We had a credit rating, I believe it was
AA minus.
Or
AA2. Mm-hmm.
And then it went up to
AA. Across all three agencies.
And so if you could give us that and what the impact was on the interest rate of that.
Sure.
And then what our credit rating is now and what it would be if it went up the logical notches.
Here's the sad point, though. The credit rating goes to all those investors who already got the bonds. So we don't necessarily get the benefit of the $2.5 billion in general fund supported debt that's already been out the door. The value we get is on the new bonds that we sell.
Right.
So
we want to know that.
Okay,
we
need to figure out, to do the math, how much of that are you going to authorize this session? So, or we have to just pick a number and say, for every $100 million of new general fund supported debt, it represents this much savings. And then I'll let you decide how many hundreds of millions we're going to do.
That would be valuable. And
I think I can do that. And I think you want me
to
do it in today's credit environment because it's a better number.
Today's credit environment, but also to look back and show us, remind us of how much money we saved on new bonding that was done after we went to the AA.
And here's, I have a little model that I use, and I can give it to you. But it's not just the state. Because when we got upgraded, GO ratings went up, our COP's ratings went up. But we also have a school bond guarantee program. So every school district in the state, and there's over $2 billion in school bond guarantees, they got an improvement too. So I'm going to do a little math on that. Okay, and again, we can't predict with any certainty how many future bonds there will be, but we'll try and make some reasonable estimates of sort of historical patterns. They all got that upgraded too. And in an environment where bond insurance is no longer available because every municipal bond insurer, bar one, has been downgraded to almost junk status, our guarantee is all that's there.
Very
so that's
good.
Worth a lot. And I think that's actually a very powerful additional reason perhaps that you may not think about as often. We have a state aid intercept, and that's why we can offer all this guarantee, because the moment somebody stumbled and fell, we just take their state aid and repay the bonds.
Senator Morris.
As bond, lost the word, but anyway, people that analyze our financial condition.
Yeah, I'm just going to write this down while we're talking so I won't forget.
To rate us, would you provide them the information that legislative revenue has done in terms of, if this bill passes, just how robust it is in...
Sure. We do. In fact, we take Paul's forecast as well as OEA's forecast of where all the different reserve funds... I believe now in the revenue forecast we're showing that table, and we didn't used to show that table. Well, we use that information, actually, before it was ever... For you all, we were working with folks at DAS and with Paul for the last few years developing that report and putting that before the rating agencies, and now... Quarterly, we just show them over and over again, look how much money is in there. I think it would be useful for maybe you should see some of the reports they write about us because they acknowledge it. And right now, we just got reconfirmed at our current credit rating, despite all these revenue problems you're hearing about. I mean, we shared that with them in January as well because we have the rainy day funds. So I can't really... I think we're all on the same page. That's super important.
Okay.
And
we have to excuse Senator Morris now because he's going to...
But I will get you... data on the value of a rating.
Great, thank you. And Senator Telford, did you have any, or Senator Rosenbaum, any other parting questions? This is a lot of information. You may be getting follow-up phone calls. And
I'm more than happy
really
to help in any way I can.
I really appreciate you coming back and doing this again. And Hopefully we won't have to bother you again this session, but you never know.
There's a lot of bills that include bonding. You'll be seeing my face.
Okay. All right.
I'm very happy to help in any way I can.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
We are adjourned.